say good afternoon and welcome to the 415th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 to promote study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. We are now in our 35th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign relations. Details about past and upcoming forum events are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. For our meeting today, we are very pleased to have a former colleague of mine, Dr. James Miller, speak to us on managing U.S. relations with China and Russia in unsettled and unsettling times. Dr. James Miller is a senior fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, where he leads a project on preventing war among great powers. Prior to his appointment at the center in October of 2014, he was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, advising Secretaries Panetta and Hagel on strategy, policy, and operations, and serving as the department's deputy for the National Security Council Policymaking and Crisis Management. Before that, Dr. Miller served as the principal deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under Secretary Gates. He has been awarded the Department of Defense's highest civilian award, the Medal for Distinguished Public Service, on four separate occasions. Dr. Miller previously served in government as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and as senior staff for the House Armed Services Committee. He has been the Senior Vice President and Director of Studies at the Center for New American Security, Senior Vice President at Hicks and Associates, and an Assistant Professor at Duke University. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He serves on the Defense Science Board and the Board of Advisors for the Center for a New American Security. Dr. Miller is also the president of Adaptive Strategies, LLC. Dr. Miller received his bachelor's degree with honors in economics from Stanford University and a master's and doctorate in public diplomacy from Harvard Kennedy School. Jim, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
George, thank you very much for that kind introduction, and thanks to all of you in the Midcoast Forum for having me here today. And sincere thanks to George and Karen, to Eric Lebson and Jim Satelli, and all the others in the room who have engaged in public service for this nation and for our allies and partners. Let me start by saying today we live in extraordinary times. I hardly have to tell you that. Granted, extraordinary does not always mean good. For example, the two world wars of the 20th century were quite extraordinary. 100 years ago today, World War I was winding down, though many thousands would die before the armistice on November 11th of 1918. 21 years after the war to end all wars, Hitler's Germany invaded Poland, effectively starting World War II, which killed upwards of 50 million people. That was also extraordinary. But it is also quite extraordinary that for the last 73 years, since the end of World War II, we've avoided war between major powers. We have not had another world war. It seems like a pretty good idea to keep that streak going for another 73 years or perhaps even more, if we can. And that's the topic I'd like to talk about today, great power relations, and specifically U.S.-Russia, U.S.-China, which are the other two major actors, the other two major powers today in the international system, and how we go forward. And I'll first set the table by talking about four unsettling realities that we need to understand and absorb in order to set a sensible course forward with Russia and with China. And let me say, although I'm talking about both, there are distinct differences between the two, and essential differences. And I'll get to some of those, not all of those differences, in the conversation. After talking about these four unsettling realities, I'll address four unsettled questions about the way forward for U.S. policy in particular, as we think about managing relations with Russia and with China. And I'll give you the correct answers to each of these four questions or at least my best cut at those. I'm sure you'll have questions about the answers and many other things. So let's first talk about what I describe as the four unsettled realities. First is the rise of China as a great power. National security experts often talk about China as a rising great power. That's accurate as far as it goes, but we need to recall that although China is rising, it also has risen. China is a great power today. We need to understand this reality and act on it as we develop policies from economics and trade to foreign policy and defense. China's economy has grown from about 5% of global GDP in 1980 to about 15% of global GDP today. For any economists in the audience, the GDP figures I'm going to use are all PPP, purchasing power parity. So you get slightly different numbers if you go for raw GDP. The World Economic Forum, which is one reasonable source on these issues because it brings together multiple other sources, projects that by 2030, China will account for about 25% of global GDP, so from 15% today to about 25% by 2030. And China's economic growth has already resulted in massive growth in its military capabilities. Its defense spending for a number of years has been growing at 10% per year steadily. So while we have sequestration go up and down, up recently, China has steadily gone up at 10% per year. You can do the compound math on that. Now, China's rise is a bit unsettling, but it's not because China's continued economic growth is going to stifle American economic growth. It won't. Mutual trade, as you all know, I hope as many of you believe, mutual trade, if it's free and fair, benefits both parties. That's why it's trade. That's why each party engages in the trade. What's unsettling about China's rise is what Graham Allison at the Kennedy School has called the Thucydides trap. And what that is that historically, in most cases, when there's a rising power in the international system that competes with the status quo power in the international system, in most cases historically, the result has been war. There are some exceptions to the rule. One of the most recent and most notable, perhaps, is the U.S. surpassing and supplanting the United Kingdom. Began World War II, but certainly after World War II, there was a transition where the UK explicitly put the mantle on the US and began to tell us, makes gentle suggestions to us what to do as part of the special relationship. But for the most part, the rule holds. Going back to Athens and Sparta in the Peloponnesian War, which started in 431 BC. That's a bit unsettling. Second unsettling reality, Russia is a revanchist power. And you've heard about this from Michael McFaul to some degree. I'll go over it quickly, but just want to refresh a little bit your memory of these issues. Russia is a revanchist power engaged in what it sees as an epic battle for survival against the United States and against our allies. Within the last few years, Russia under Putin has seized Crimea, invaded Ukraine with little green men. It's worked to destabilize other neighbors, including in particular Georgia, but also other countries on its periphery. Obviously, it interfered in the U.S. election in 2016, has continued its propaganda campaigns, and is postured to interfere in 2018 and going forward. Russia's placed malware in the U.S. electrical grid in case the United States has an idea to escalate in cyberspace. I'll come back to this issue. And also malware critical infrastructure of our allies and partners. Has violated the INF Treaty, has violated other treaties, has assassinated enemies of the state or perceived enemies of the state in the United Kingdom and elsewhere. And Russia has taken disinformation to a new level. If you want to really see fake news, tune into RT, Russian state television. All in all, as we may not be in a new Cold War, but as Mike McFaul said, former Ambassador Mike McFaul said, and as he titled his book, we are certainly in a very cold peace. Let me say, I'll come back to this. I spent a lot of my time in government trying to work out rules of the road and arms control as I worked with George, with Russia. It's important that we do that, and I'll come back to those points later, but we need to do so with open eyes. Russia as a revanchist power, that's unsettling reality number two. The third unsettling reality I want to talk about is the changing nature of warfare as we shift not just as a nation, but globally from the industrial age to an age that can fairly be described as information age. there are resulting changes across the spectrum of conflict. I've talked really implicitly about the low end of conflict, Russian interference in our elections and so forth. China's theft of intellectual property would be in that category as well. Somewhat higher on an escalation ladder, we see both China and Russia engaging in so-called gray zone aggression. That includes in cyberspace, but it also includes for China seizing islands in the South China Sea and protecting them with so-called white hull vessels. For us, that would be Coast Guard, for example, not military vessels. And for Russia, this gray zone activity is included the use of little green men, cyber attacks, disinformation, and so on. Higher on the conflict scale, where I want to spend more time in discussion, not more time not to have the country spend more time on it. If armed conflict looks likely between the United States and China or the United States and Russia, there will be overwhelming incentives on both sides of that conflict to go early and hard in cyberspace and in outer space to negate the other side's military capabilities and potentially to apply coercive pressure as well. From a military perspective, early moves against the other side in cyberspace and outer space offer the possibility to degrade the other side's command, control, and communications, slow its movement of forces, disrupt its supply chain and logistical support, make smart weapons dumb, and generally make the adversary's enemy forces a lot less effective, all with no bombs, no invasion, just fried computers and dead satellites. So large-scale cyber and space attacks before a conflict ever starts in the ground, air, or sea are likely to look very appealing for both sides. They're likely to be fundamental to the way in which a conflict would start. And indeed, if one side thinks it can do what used to be called a shot across the bow or other actions to deter the other side late, you'll see a lot of activity in outer space and cyberspace even before you have a war starting. A minor problem with this, the potential for escalation will be very serious. So to the extent that an attacker's cyber and space attacks are successful, whether it's us attacking Russia or China or conversely, the other side might, in theory, back down. That will be the hope. That will be the premise of conducting those attacks, gain advantage, so then a better position for bargaining. Very possibly, the other side could escalate instead and believe that it may have to use or lose its remaining military capabilities. And this is where there's a big gap in the escalation ladder, if you will. Guess what? Our nuclear forces, Russian, Chinese nuclear forces, depend very heavily on both embedded IT and on networking as well, and on space assets that provide early warning and secure communications. So there's the significant potential as we look at this new world where cyber in particular plays in day-to-day low-level aggression would be fundamental to the escalation of that aggression into the gray zone and into the early parts of conflict. There's a significant possibility of rapid escalation, and we have not fully explored the implications of this as a country, let alone in bilateral discussions with Russia and China. I'll come back to that. But the risks are profound. The risks are compounded by the possibility of so-called black hat attacks, another country undertaking an attack that looks like a Russian or China on us, or conversely, and by the possibility of cascading effects. So we're looking at the possibility of a slippery slope. We don't understand these dynamics well. We've never fought wars before that were predominantly and first and foremost in cyberspace and outer space. That's the future that we're headed towards. And it's an unsettling reality, and that's unsettling reality number three. If that particular one intrigues you, let me know afterwards. I'll direct you to a website where several articles I've co-authored on that topic, which will get into some of the approaches to deal with the challenge in more detail than I can today. The fourth unsettling reality I want to talk about today is perhaps the most unsettling of all, and that is that U.S. global preeminence that we've had since 1945, economically, diplomatically, and militarily, is coming to an end. Since the end of World War II, the United States has served as the global leader in establishing and financing global institutions, including the UN, the World Bank, IMF, and so on. Through the Marshall Plan, the U.S. paid to rebuild the economies and societies of our adversaries, Germany and Japan, We've done similar actions elsewhere in the world, and the U.S. supported regional stability through our alliances and partnerships with four deployed troops across the globe. Some of that is still true. The U.S. continues to have the greatest military in the world, in the history of the world. But the era of the U.S. being able to impose its will on others in the way in which we perceived that we could, at least during, particularly since the end of the Cold War, has closed. The U.S. still has a vibrant economy, which will continue to ensure that we are a great power. And by the way, by 2030, the World Economic Forum projection is that the U.S. will still have sustained its roughly 15% of global GDP corrected for purchasing power parity, as China has gone up to 25%. Again, the raw numbers are much closer than those two. That's still a lot, and let me be clear, the U.S. economy is projected to grow a tremendous amount. There's room for 3 to 4% of GDP easily for the military budget within that. The disparity is occurring because China's economy and even more India's and a few others' economies are projected to grow much more rapidly than the United States. This is not an absolute decline by the United States. It's not necessarily a decline in the leadership role of the United States, but the ability to impose our will through being the biggest kid on the block is in the prospect of changes. And let me say, it's been fun to be the biggest kid on the block in many ways. You get to set the rules, you get to bend and sometimes break the rules when you want to, and you get to make huge mistakes. In my judgment, the war in Vietnam and the 2003 invasion of Iraq were both big strategic mistakes by the United States. Squandered tens of thousands of American lives, cost trillions of dollars, and distracted us from other problems both at home and abroad. We can argue that point, but we will not have the discretion to make major strategic errors as a nation in the future, particularly as regards to great power competition, potential conflict, and for that matter, setting up great power cooperation, which I'd like to talk about as well. We can't borrow our way out of that in the future, in part because of our not just our relative declining economy, but even more so because of our budget deficits. We're going to have to act smarter as a nation, and that is going to be hard to do in the near term, as our domestic politics have hit, I think, pretty close to unprecedented levels of partisanship and fecklessness. That's unsettling reality number four. I'm going to add some hope now, because if we have a clear-eyed assessment of where we stand, a clear-eyed assessment of China, of Russia, and of ourselves, and of the nature of war, then we'll be able to set more effective policies. So these four unsettling issues or realities raise a number of questions. I want to just address four of those, and they're unsettled questions. First, how should we compete? So I'll talk about competition. I'll talk about conflict or preparing for conflict. I'll talk about cooperation as well, and then I'll talk about U.S. domestic perspective as well. So how do we compete with Russia and China, including the so-called gray zone? Let me very quickly say, and we can talk about the details here. First, in the economic arena, the United States should continue to press for free and fair trade. I support the Trump administration's objective of achieving free and fair trade. I think that the playing field has been uneven. I don't particularly think that setting the playing field on fire is the most effective approach to dealing with that, in part because we get scorched a bit, but our allies and partners get scorched more. And the trust that's required for partnership in trade and leadership globally is not enhanced by being perceived as an arsonist. So I support the Trump administration's objectives, I'd like to see a somewhat different approach than we've seen predominantly. So one is free and fair trade. That's still very much in our national interest. We have to make big changes in the economy. We can do that. Second, in political competition, including in the so-called gray zone, the United States needs to be clear about what we see as the rules of the game, and then we need to abide by those rules and enforce those rules. And let me take one example just to take it out of this sphere of day-to-day and tie it back into the possibility of conflict. And let's talk about, since I mentioned cyberspace and outer space, I'll give an example from each. One question we need to answer, is it legitimate for one side to preposition destructive malware in the critical infrastructure of the other side? The US government and multiple private companies have indicated that Russia has done that to the United States in our electrical grid and other parts of our critical infrastructure. They've pulled the trigger on such malware against Ukraine and to some extent against Georgia. Is that legitimate? And if not, what are the consequences? If it's legitimate to do it, to put them in but not to use it, what's deterrence look like? There are a number of questions that need to be addressed. And to pretend that it's not happening, or to pretend that it's only Russia that does it and other countries do not, or that we may not, is not a productive approach. Second, is it legitimate for one side to maneuver a satellite close to another side, the other side's satellite, to observe it, to be able to bump it, to be able to do other things? Yes or no? That is an unresolved issue today. The stability of the situation in outer space will depend in part on being able to answer questions like this. We need to work through these answers. The United States, we need to work with our allies and partners. We need to talk to the Russians and Chinese about these questions. Third, the United States, still within this first category, the United States needs to hit back hard to impose costs in order to enforce norms and protect our interests. And I wanted to talk a bit about Russia's interference in our election and what we should be doing. First, we should be putting much stronger sanctions in place. Second, we need to bolster international support to sustain the pain on Russia and on Putin. Third, and this is often not talked about in polite company, we need to develop cyber options that hold at risk what President Putin values, and to be prepared to use them in case he thinks the answer to our escalation and imposition of costs is to escalate in cyberspace, because we have a long way to go before we can defend what we need to be able to impose costs. And fourth, we need to push back on Russian influence operations with truth. We should not be engaged in disinformation, absolutely. Fifth, continue to encourage Facebook, Twitter, Google, and others to continue to step up so that they're tools of democracy, not of democracy's demise. And fourth, over time, it's a big lift, but we need to improve the security of our critical infrastructure. That's a decades-long task. By prioritizing, we could significantly improve the security of our electoral infrastructure, of our electrical grid, and of the financial sector relatively soon. It'll take time for us to move out of the cyber glass house, but we need to begin that move. So that's a first set of questions, and I've given you a sense of how we should compete economically and diplomatically. Second unsettled question is, how should we prepare for potential conflict with Russia and China? We're preparing for it because we want to deter it effectively. And if it occurs, we want it to end without going to nuclear war and terminate it on grounds that are satisfactory to the United States and acceptable to the other party. So U.S. policy is to pursue military superiority over all other nations, including over Russia and China. I'm not making that up. Read the National Defense Strategy. It's not new to this administration. It was the policy of during the Obama administration as well. And that specifically includes military support superiority vis-a-vis Russia and China, which is a heavy lift. On the other side of the ledger, China wants to be able to deter and, if necessary, defeat the U.S. if the U.S. attempts to impose its will on China or thwart China's ambitions. Similarly, Russia desires to be able to deter the United States and NATO from imposing their will on Russia. All of these are in competition. It does not mean that there's a necessity for conflict. And none of these efforts is nefarious. This is what major powers do. They prepare for conflict. They work to posture themselves to protect their interests in case things go that direction. So the military competition with Russia and China, in my judgment, should be guided by six key principles. First, double down in areas of U.S. advantage. I'm going to pick on each of the services here just for fun. Let me start with the Navy. So to pick on the Navy first, we continue to build multi-billion-dollar warships for the surface, which have an important role, but that will be vulnerable in the event of a conflict with Russia or China. Meanwhile, we've allowed our inventory of attack submarines, which exist in one domain undersea where we have current clear superiority. They've come down from about 65 to 52 today. They'll decline to 42. The Navy's requirement, which I think is actually on the low side, is 66. So we're investing more on the surface. We're not investing undersea where we have dominance. I'll pick on the Air Force now. The Air Force recently came out and said it was going to grow by, needed to grow by 25% from 312 to 386 operational squadrons. This growth is unaffordable and unnecessary. The Air Force should be focused on the quality more than the quantity. That's what is most important for any conflict and therefore for deterrence with a major power. And that means so-called fifth generation and moving on toward the sixth generation and retiring older planes to save money. Number three on this point of how to prepare for potential conflict is remember, we are not going to invade Russia or China. Now I'm picking on the Army. We need to sustain and improve the best trained, best equipped ground forces in the world. But we don't need a larger army. I usually don't go out and criticize the military. I think there's still important changes that come from Secretary Mattis's guidance to pursue military superiority that we'll see how those play out next few cycles. And fourth, related to my broader point, we need to bolster the cyber resilience of the military platforms, key military platforms as well. Most importantly, those that are critical for non-nuclear deterrence and for nuclear deterrence. Long-range strike, the B-21 bomber that's being developed, and so forth. Number five, within this category of how to prepare for conflict, we need to innovate. Military innovation is easy to talk about and hard to do. Let me make two quick points and leave the rest for the Q&A. To their credit, the last few secretaries of defense have really emphasized promoting innovation. To no one's surprise, point two, to no one's surprise, there's been relatively little progress in accelerating innovation or accelerating the acquisition process. Work to do there. And number six, this is the place where I've spent a lot of my time since out of government doing more in-depth work. At six, not because it's least important, but because it builds on the other points, and I want to emphasize it. Six, we need to work to promote strategic stability so we don't stumble into a conflict, so that escalation occurs by choice, not by inadvertence, and so that we don't have miscommunication that turns into a war. And some examples of a long list. We need to invest in survivable nuclear systems. Our so-called boomers, our SSBNs, are the most important element, and highly resilient nuclear command and control. That is a big bill. Second, we need to work to extend and expand and sustain arms control agreement, particularly important at the strategic level, the New START agreement, but others as well. And third, in addition to the do's, there are some don'ts. One don't, and it's at the top of the list, we should not be deploying space-based interceptors or space-based directed energy systems for missile defense or anti-satellite weapons. If we go that direction, we will destabilize outer space and bring on the crisis that we thought we would avoid. Two more unsettled questions, and I'm going to go through them pretty quickly. The third unsettled question is, how should we pursue cooperation with Russia and China? The most important point here is that we should pursue cooperation with Russia and China. And I'll just mention three buckets. Bucket one is to seriously and persistently engage in strategic stability talks, including arms control talks, so that if push comes to shove in a crisis, and historically this does happen between great powers, that we have had discussions about these issues and that we have some common set of expectations. And good on the Trump administration for beginning these talks, which they have. These talks should not be subject to the vicissitudes of the relationship. They're all the more important when they're bouncy elements to the relationship. They should be insulated. Bucket two is to build contacts at all levels. Congress has limited the extent to which the military can have so-called mill-to-mill contacts with Russia. This makes, to me, no sense. We should build the contacts not just through the State Department, but through the Defense Department and other departments. Historically, in crisis, having not just connections at the top, but at multiple levels, if they are coordinated, reduces the risk of miscommunication, misperception, and stumbling into war. And bucket three is to build cooperation on global issues, in areas ranging from North Korea to Iran to nonproliferation, and right now, obviously, a place we have a hiatus with this administration's views on climate change. We should also look to expand our joint ventures with these countries, particularly with respect to outer space as we look to go from the International Space Station to the Moon, to the Mars over time, potentially beyond, partnering with Russia, China, and for that matter, other great nations, including India, will be fundamentally important. There are technology transfer risks that have to be weighed. They should not stop us from building that cooperation. Fourth unsettled question, and I'll finish with this. Can we get our domestic politics in order in order to establish both domestic tranquility, in order to both promote the common good within the country, but for the purposes of this talk, in order to have sensible, sustained foreign policy and defense approaches relative to Russia and China. Of all the challenges that I've gone through, I think this one is the toughest. In part, and I think it feels that way in part because we're close to it and we understand it better. It's also it's tough because it's in a sense a prerequisite for making progress on the other items as well. A Texas friend of mine often says, "Y'all don't find nothing in the middle of the road except dead armadillos." We need to build a path down the middle of the road, and it is a dangerous place to be in U.S. politics today. I'm not deeply expert on this. I'll make a couple of observations. Big money that tends to support the far left and the far right in the primary process. Gerrymandering that makes so many House districts non-competitive. The shift from broadcast to narrowcast and selective internet browsing on the news so people keep getting their biases reinforced. Let me give you a couple of positive stories to finish. Some in Congress, including George's and my former boss, Liam Panetta, son, Jimmy Panetta, have started something called the Problem Solvers Caucus. It has 48 members today. So out of 435, right? 48 members, 24 Democrats, 24 Republicans. If you want to join, if you're a Democrat, you got to bring in a Republican. If you're Republican, you got to bring in a Democrat. Okay? It's committed to finding bipartisan approaches on issues from healthcare, immigration, gun safety, infrastructure investments, and to reforming the rules of the House. One thing that I've represented is one thing that the caucus has found out is that, and experienced on each of those issues, the House majority can block progress even if a majority of members of the House, let alone a majority of the population, support an issue. So now if we can grow that Problem Solvers Caucus from 48 to 50 to dot, 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 218 is a good number. That's, it gives you a majority in the House. It's a long road. I'll come back to one way we can do that. And I'll say, if we can't get true campaign finance reform, which it looks like, if you thought it was hard in previous Supreme Courts, it doesn't look very likely for some time to come. In addition, I guess really two final points on this. There are a number of former, both retired military and former civilians in government running for office today. Two of them happened to work for me. I really feel like I worked with them. Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan, Josh Welly in New Jersey. Both of them, like Jimmy Panetta did, although they are running as Democrats, they're running on a platform of problem solving and bipartisanship. Don't know if they're going to win, but there are many others of that ilk, many who've served in national service, most of whom have been in uniform. And that's a reason for hope as well. Maine has had some of the great leaders I had in the past who have promoted bipartisanship. I had the great honor to work in Congress at the same time that George Mitchell was there, Senator George Mitchell, and I in Congress during the time Bill Cohen was there, and worked for him as Secretary of Defense. There is a possibility, and I say Angus King, not to do a political endorsement, as an observer from outside the state, someone who's not just independent but seems to have worked hard to find that common ground. Whatever it is you have up here in the Maine water, or maybe it's in the ice and snow, we need more of it across the United States and particularly in the swampland of Washington. And let me say, I know, as I've listened to myself in this talk, I'm concluding here, that it sounded in some ways pessimistic. Big challenges, hard to get our act together to address those. Fundamentally, I'm profoundly optimistic on these topics and about the future of the country. We've been through tough times before. We've been through a civil war. Our institutions and our people fundamentally have found a way forward. To paraphrase Winston Churchill, Americans always find the right way forward after we've tried everything else. We've tried pretty close to everything else, you know. It doesn't happen automatically or automagically. It happens because people stand up and take action within our institutional processes, within the law. And I'm glad to talk further about U.S. domestic politics, where I'm a participant but not an expert. I'm glad to talk more about national security, where I was once a participant and hope that I'm now an expert in the Q&A. I welcome your comments and questions. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Jim. You've given us a lot to think about and a lot, I think, to ask questions about. I always take the prerogative of the moderator to ask the first question while we collect questions from the audience. And I was struck by the fact that one of the things you said we needed to do was maintain strategic stability through dialogue, et cetera. And in the post-World War II institutions that were set up, were designed in a big part to promote strategic stability or stability in the world, and those are fading. Is there something that's going to replace those, or is there a plan for where we go next? What do you think?
There's not a good plan at this point of which I'm aware, either for the sort of the high politics, what used to be called the high politics strategic stability of arms control and great power, nuclear arms control, conventional arms control, and so on. I don't believe arms control is dead. I think it needs to be revitalized and it needs to be refocused. And as it addresses cyber and space, because of the challenges of verification, that will have to be heavily about norms and rules of the road rather than, in my view, treaties. It's not dead, it needs to be reinvigorated. So, you know, on the broader set of the Bretton Woods infrastructure that was set up after World War II and so forth, my view is that we had what amounted to an implicit roadmap of going forward with the Trans-Pacific Partnership and then similarly with Europe. Many of us believe that we then needed to expand those to include, to offer condition-based membership for China and for Russia and to use that as a tool. We've moved away from those free trade elements, and we've not taken steps, in my view, to make the World Bank, IMF, and other institutions effective. Instead, China has begun to set up its own financing mechanisms. Some of our allies and partners have joined in those. So a hard press on that set of issues for the future economic system and financials is important as well. I don't see it happening today, and I don't know. I don't know that it can be accomplished given today's domestic politics. So making progress on the domestic politics side may be a prerequisite.
Thank you. One of these that struck me as I was looking through these was the fact that you didn't speak about where you see North Korea in this analysis. And to me, it invokes the question of areas where there is real conflict between major powers. How is that going to play into all this? I mean, we just ignore it? We're cooperative? What happens?
This administration has chosen to do first a bilateral approach and then to work on the periphery of that bilateral discussion with our allies, in particular South Korea and Japan, and particularly with China, which holds the most influence over North Korea. In short, I believe a window is opened that hasn't been opened in the past. You can debate why it opened, but fundamental to it, I think, is Kim Jong-un deciding he's gotten far enough in his missile and nuclear testing, but it's open. There's a possibility of significant progress, and the administration has appointed an incredibly talented individual named C. Began as a lead negotiator, who is held in very high regard by everyone I know who's ever worked with him. So there's a real opportunity here. So it will be pushed forward in the bilateral channel, work the other channels in parallel, and then prepare yourself for something less than full denuclearization. Kim Jong-un has said publicly a number of times that he looked at what happened to Saddam Hussein. He looked at what happened to Muammar Gaddafi after they gave up their nuclear programs, and he's not sure that he wants to go the same path. And the North Koreans have made very clear recently that the United States must make big concessions, not just at the end of the process, but sooner rather than later. So it's going to be a bouncy, circuitous road. There's a possibility of a deal in our interest, and we will have to work with the other parties, even if it's not in a five-party construct. or any other, any other similar construct.
What are your thoughts on the recent cooperation between China and Russia? Do you think that will have significant impact on the U.S. relationship with these two countries? That's the broader question of cooperation, not between the U.S. and each of these, but between those countries themselves.
Three quick points. First, I see it as a sign that China and Russia still see the United States as a very powerful country. In a sense, you can take that as a compliment, right? It's a military where they see the advantage of partnering together, not just on arms sales, but in showing a degree of combined resolve. Second, I don't think there's any real prospect, unless the United States really fouls up its foreign policy, of pushing that China and Russia come together in a lasting alliance that looks anything like NATO or anything of that genre. I think that is highly unlikely because of their divergent interests, their divergent perspectives, and the competition that they have, not just along their border, but in the region. And third, it's a reminder that we need to continue to bolster our alliances. One of the great advantages that we've had as a country, particularly since the end of World War II, is that other countries want to be partners and allies with us. It's not just a place to base our forces and go fight their wars. It's a way to strengthen the international system, to reduce any benefit an aggressor could perceive achieving by engaging in overt or covert or mass conflict. And so it's a reminder to us how important our alliances are and that we need to tend to those and, frankly, tend to them more effectively than that's happened recently.
Then here's one that kind of has another aspect of the problem. What would happen with the world's economic order and the security order and stability if China's economy falters or collapses, or put Russia in place of China or the United States in place of either? I mean, if there's a massive change in what the current direction looks like.
China's economy has become integral, not just to the region, but globally. And if China sneezes, the world will catch cold. Right? And just as the same will be true of the United States. In many ways, our economy is more impactful, although by purchasing power parity, it's, they're roughly equal. We're driving the technology more. China's coming up in that area. And we have established trade with other major countries that hopefully we will sustain. It will matter. And one of the disincentives to war is that China needs global markets for its products and to support its people and to support all of the major investment projects that they have that, as they head into a very difficult decade of the 2020s, when their population flips largely because of the one-child policy, they're going to have some very difficult challenges internally. They need a vibrant economy to power through that.
What happens in the U.S.-Russian relationship if Putin were suddenly removed? I.e., how much does this depend on the exact leadership in all of our countries?
Given the power structure in Russia today, which some have called an oligarchy, some have called a kleptocracy, and that's pretty strong words, but I think it's pretty accurate. If Putin is removed or gets hit by a bus, there'll be another person very much like Vladimir Putin, perhaps without his horseback riding capabilities and articulateness and other dimensions that make him. I say that somewhat in jest. He's a dynamic, incredibly intelligent, powerful leader. So there may be a slip because if they don't have someone as articulate and dynamic. But the prospect of someone coming in, by analogy, a Gorbachev figure, is infinitesimal.
Here's one on kind of how third parties enter into this. Specifically, how should the U.S. use her relation with India to maintain advantage positions against Russia and China, keeping in mind that India has a friendly relationship with Russia and is a rival of China and Palestine and Pakistan?
It's a great question. India will have at least as much to say about that as the United States. First thing to understand, India has a long history of a desire for balancing and leadership in the so-called non-alignment movement during the Cold War. One of the things that, when I got to know my Indian counterparts, when we do meetings, I would often say is that were two great democracies that are destined to grow closer together. It was not something that all Indians want to hear. I think the trends are very positive in that regard, that the oldest democracy and the most populous democracy in the world, and India is an emerging great power. I don't believe it has emerged as a great power. I believe it will do so in the coming decade or so. More important than the counterbalancing and using India on the flank of China and so forth, which you'll hear in my view, is ensuring that India's, as it rises, it improves its ability to govern, and its the ability of its government to operate effectively and meet the needs of its people, which will be very challenging, even as it has this incredible economic growth that's projected in the 2020s as it hits the sweet spot that China's had for the last 20 years. But having India as a strong player and a supporter of the international system, of an international system of free and fair trade that enforces norms, behavior, I think makes tremendous sense. And trying to pull them away from Russia or against China, I think, is not a smart play for the United States. I don't think it would work, and I think even if it did work to some degree, it's a far smarter and more effective play, even from a narrow national interest perspective, to work with India as to be a co-custodian of an updated international system.
There are several here on kind of the role of international organizations or new organizations. Let me just read three of them here, and you can respond kind of in general, I think. One is, does a world police force, Russia, China, U.S., other, make sense to reduce the likelihood of war in the future?
No. No, because we can't. Because we still live in a Hobbesian world. We're going more that direction than away from it. And attempting to impose that kind of order would certainly have counterproductive effects as one of the, you know, one of the potential pathways to major war. Sorry, that's a more expansive.
How is the potential for conflict between a status quo power and a rising power been affected by the installment of international institutions like the UN? Has it changed it at all? And what should the U.S. policy be re the International Criminal Court? So it's all of those who are related to organizations that have supposedly some overarching influence.
One of the reasons the transition from the UK, from Great Britain to the United States as the predominant great power, you know, notwithstanding the USSR at the time, a degree of common language and common understanding. In my estimation, the bigger reason is that the United States took it upon itself, and with Britain's encouragement, to be a custodian, to be a creator and a custodian of a post-World War II international system that was incredibly beneficial to us, with free and fair trade by countries who were devastated by war. What that meant was they would grow, but we would have trade that advanced our economy as well. So to the extent that we build strong institutions in which China and Russia are participants and feel a stake in ownership, we reduce the probability of war significantly. On the International Criminal Court, on the whole, we should be supporting it. We should make clear that internationally, we're not just a nation of laws for Americans or for a subset of Americans. We believe in the rule of law internationally. There are periods, and I've been involved in some, where we disagree with an individual case. I was involved where a service member was, seven service members were being taken forward. One of them was held by the Italians, and we had some very tricky negotiations. So there are individual cases where we will disagree with the International Criminal Court, but on the whole, we should support it and advance it.
Let me switch gears here and give you one that's near and dear to my heart. What is the effect on U.S. policy of Russia's medium-range nuclear missile? A new one's been reported. Do we need to match it with our own? Do we need to do tit for tat?
No. So the military effect of that missile is near zero. It's only near zero because there is a slight tactical and operational advantage in being able to launch short time-of-flight missiles against critical targets and to hit them before the other sides can react and put its defenses into effective place, or if they have sufficient mass to overwhelm those defenses. So it does offer a slight advantage. The fundamental problem with the Russians' violation of the INF Treaty is that it is a treaty violation, and if we're going to have domestic support for treaties, we need to hold the other party to account for them. the appropriate response to the Russian action is, you know, first keep pushing them to reverse course, and second, in my view, and I've written about this, so this is no, you know, this isn't off the top of my head. We should go back. We used to have nuclear tipped sea-launched cruise missiles. You recall that one of the things that we eliminated in the 2009 nuclear posture review was the so-called TLAM-N. We should go back. We should set a program in place, and this administration has done so. Set a program in place to go back to nuclear-armed sea-launched cruise missiles. And since Jim Mattis said it publicly, I feel comfortable saying it publicly. If the Russians change their course, we can change our course. On the other hand, if you're going to have a situation where you're concerned about the credibility of a strategic weapon going into response for a shorter range system, and there is an argument and I about that credibility in my view, then the TLAM-N or a future sea-launched cruise missile that has that capability closes that gap. I would recommend that we go that direction and use it as part of what we can place on the table for future negotiation on tactical nuclear weapons, as well as reinforcement and reinstatement of INF.
Can we go back to the questions on economics? You said you disagree with President Trump's tariff approach to China. What approach will best promote fair trade with China?
Yeah, I think that raising tariffs can be a useful tactic, but in order to make it most effective, in order to make it have a reasonable probability to be effective, you want to present to the other side what the end game is, what a package deal looks like that would be desirable for both sides. And I think that unless the administration has articulated that privately to China, which I don't think is the case, I don't believe it's described that end game. The tit for tat is not helpful for multiple reasons. The reality is that China will be hurt more by a trade war than will the United States, in my view, for the direct effects. China will be hurt more because of the nature of the trade imbalance. The indirect effects, the United States will be hurt more because our reliability as a trading partner with other countries will go down, and because we'll have the cost associated with the transition of jobs and so forth, that was unnecessary friction. So the bottom line is we should be looking to an end state where we have reduced tariffs on both sides, where China doesn't just agree to stop stealing IP, intellectual property, but takes further steps than they've taken so far. They have reduced it since Obama's request to Xi Jinping that they stop. Present that to the Chinese as a package, and then use tariffs and other tools in order to push toward that outcome.
Here's a different type of question related to economics. If the U.S. should lose its role as global economic leader and the dollar as its preeminence, won't all of these foreign-held dollars of reserve currency come home? To what effect as we transition to not being the world power economically?
There's already some significant diversification from the dollar, particularly China, but also a significant degree the euro. I think that that's going to happen gradually. I think the reality is that it has been very much in our interest to be the currency of choice, if you will, for the globe, and that over time that is going to go down. It would go down whether or not we had the policies of the current administration. It will likely go down faster because of that and in ways that will cause more dislocation. Over time, there'll be a new equilibrium. My preference is that we get there gradually. I would love the U.S. to continue to have that preeminence. I don't think that it'll be the case 50 years down the road. I don't think it'll be the case 50 years down the road, and I think we need to plan for that future.
I have a whole table still here full of questions, so I apologize if I didn't get to yours. But I wanted to do one more question. So as a final question, regarding building alliances and the U.S. role in the world, is Trump's approach to diplomacy going to diminish or help us?
Let me talk about the silver lining first, and then I'll talk about the big dark cloud. The silver lining is, as an example, Secretary Gates, Secretary Panetta, Secretary Hagel all went to our NATO allies and said, you've got to put in more. You've got to put in more for your defense. 2% is the target. Germany is like at 1%. Most other of our NATO allies are in that roughly 1% or less range. It was the last meeting that Gates had as secretary. It turned out to be the last meeting that Secretary Panetta had, was at NATO. When Secretary Hagel came in, I said, there's one way you might make it not your last meeting. Make it your first, and then, you know, I said leave early. I didn't intend it to turn out the way that it did. So the silver lining is that by appearing as a less reliable ally, many of our NATO allies and others are looking to boost their defense spending. That's the silver lining. The downside is that the credibility of the alliance in the eyes of anyone who would go against it, whether it's a North Korea, whether it's a Russia or a China, the credibility of the alliance and the perceived will of the United States to commit resources and lives in defense of that territory and of that relationship is significantly reduced. And that means that our security, in my view, is lower and substantially lower. I like it when our allies do more. That's great. They should be doing more, no question. The most important question, does North Korea do some stupid thing to South Korea, or does Russia do something in the Baltics, or does China take steps against our allies and partners in the region? The most important question, will the United States have their back? That is now less certain than it was previously. That increased the risks of war. That is not in our interest.